Good morning. Hey, Harry.
Good morning, Babs.
Good morning, Jeff Grant. How are you?
You know, I think when people tune in, they think there's some kind of inside joke going on here just before the show.
I think it is.
They'll
never know unless they are watching on Facebook.
The pre-show, like Oprah.
Thank you all for tuning in to Criminal Justice Insider. I am Babs Rawls-Ivey.
And I'm Jeff Grant.
And this wonderful show is sponsored by the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven.
Now more than ever.
And hello to our lovely significant others.
See, how come every week I say Andrew Kaplan and you say
Lynn Springer?
Yeah, why is that? I can't figure that out.
I don't know. Do you want to just say your wife's name?
Lynn Springer. I say it a lot, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
And happy birthday to her.
Oh, yeah.
Happy birthday.
Absolutely. She got a lot of likes on Facebook for someone who doesn't have a Facebook account.
I know, but she's so beautiful looking. Like, people are like, is she a movie star?
Yeah, so. Well, she's embarrassed right now if she's listening.
So our guest today is Michael Kimmelman, former hedge fund founder and manager who was incarcerated for a white collar crime. Did you move some money? Is that what happened?
Not quite, but it's within the ballpark.
We are going to learn about it.
So we're going to learn about it, but we want to give some shout outs. Jeff and Jackie Polvari are going to speak October 30th at the Western Connecticut State University event. What is that event?
That is a criminal justice panel. I think we're the only ones on the panel, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
But the wonderful Marilyn Kane and her husband George, both who are affiliated with the university, invited us to speak.
Nice.
So it's at 5:30 at their Westside campus, 43 Lake Avenue Extension, and everybody's invited. It is free to the public, and we hope everyone will come out, and we certainly hope our community will come out there. It's going to be a good night, especially for people who are underserved and underrepresented.
Mm-hmm. And then both of you all are going to be speaking at Albertus Magnus on November 14th.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, we're making the rounds.
Okay.
So
I see. They're like Sonny and Cher.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, there's a few things coming up. So, you know, Jackie had her retreat, and you and I both spoke at that. So
I just hung out. I really just hung out.
Is that true?
Yeah, I hung out. I got there for lunch and stayed till dinner.
But I thought you were actually a presenter.
I mean, it was informal. We just chatted.
Oh, nice.
So it was nice. Like, nice. It wasn't, you know.
Nice. Did they ask you for your autograph?
I hope not. No. I made some new friends, though. So it was really good, nice. Yeah. So it was good. So, all right. So Michael Kimmelman is a former hedge fund founder and manager who was convicted and incarcerated for a white-collar crime. You're a member of the white-collar support group that Jeff runs, which is wonderful. And so you're here to talk a little bit about your life and the stuff that you're doing to empower people with the skills and mindset to become resilient and prosper in the face of adversity.
How about that? Plug the book up at the beginning, too.
I don't see it.
No, page two, there's a star by it.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Let's see. What is it? Oh, you have a book.
I do.
Confessions of a Wall Street Insider, a cautionary tale of rats, feds, and banksters. That sounds like today. Except they're all sitting in Washington.
So it's nonfiction.
It's perpetual. Not much has changed.
So how are you? Welcome to Criminal Justice Insider.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm great.
So where would you like to start? Anywhere in your story?
You tell me. You know, I could start from the beginning.
Yeah, start from the beginning.
But I'll make it quick. Yep. I won't dive too deep. We've got the book for that if you want to get into the nitty gritty. But
did you bring a copy of the book so we could hold it up? No.
I did not, but I do have one in the car.
Okay.
For emergency situations, I keep one. I grew up in Los Angeles. And went to East Coast for college, West Coast for law school, then took a job with a New York law firm, Sullivan & Cromwell, which was one of the big New York law firms, because I thought that's where, you know, the action was.
Prestigious.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, worked that job for a few years, met some great people, It was the late 90s, and there was a lot more interesting things happening in tech and finance.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of was tiring of sleeping under my desk a couple nights a week, as people are apt to do in big law. So I lateraled over to finance and then worked for a series of firms, a series of hedge funds, did very well, and then eventually started my own fund called Incremental Capital in about late 2007, early 2008. And as part of that, it was obviously the timing was not the greatest timing. It was as the onset of the financial crisis. We actually did really well managing that crisis. But after we had gotten to the other side of it, at least from a financial point of view, in late 2009, the FBI kicked down my door. And that was a part of this Galleon case. My partner, who I had brought into my hedge fund and made a full partner, had worked directly for Raj Rajaratnam. Now, Raj was a big shot on Wall Street. He was the founder of Galleon, which was a big hedge fund. And Raj had done some things, you know, that were suspect and that were criminal, it turns out.
One of the early big names in this wave of white-collar insider trading.
There had not been a real wave of insider trading prosecutions in 20 years since Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky. Those are the names that people are familiar with. And then Raj and a series of other people were arrested, my partner as part of that. And then there were nine other people in my case that were arrested as part of that series of prosecutions.
Sanjay Gupta, right?
Not Sanjay. Was it Sanjay? I think the CNN
contributor. Oh, yeah, I think I mixed that up.
His time might be coming, but I don't think so.
Gupta,
yeah,
Gupta.
Rajat Gupta, Rajat, who was a Goldman Sachs board member who had been prosecuted and convicted of leaking tips to Raj. And there were some other people in this conspiracy. But in my case, there was about nine of us. And, you know, obviously, this was a very different timeline and sort of scenario. But the feds came in, you know, SWAT team, guns drawn, drug dogs, and basically terrorized my family. We lived up in, you know, Westchester, 5 a.m. And basically, you know, without a single question being asked, said, hey, you know, either you cooperate right now or you'll see your kids when they're in high school. And I had three young kids at the time. I think my oldest was seven. And then I had boys 5 and 2. And I didn't even know at this point what I was being arrested for and did not cooperate, and then was, you know, obviously charged and prosecuted, and we made the case to drop the case, and they came back, the feds came back a couple weeks later and said, look, based on this new information, which wasn't new information, it's just information they didn't know, we think your guy is a peripheral player in this and different from the others.
Meaning you.
Yes, meaning me. If he pleads guilty to one count of conspiracy, we'll give him probation and no fine. So it was very much a, hey, get out of the case. We may have made a mistake, but we've already paraded you on CNBC and handcuffs and everything else. So we can't obviously drop the case because that would be a career killer for someone. But, you know, they offered me the probation plea and they said, look, you're the only one that didn't have a prepaid cell phone in your case. You're the only one who didn't pay or receive cash bribes. Just take the plea and go away. And as somebody who didn't, you know, think he did anything wrong, didn't do anything illegal, in my opinion, which later turned out to be true as well, and borne out, I didn't want to take that plea. I was very stubborn to some degree. And, you know, again, we can talk about it later, too. I also had a bit of a substance abuse problem and was drinking heavily due to the pressures of the arrest and the case and whatnot. But that didn't start then. That was a 25-year type of, you know, affliction. But I didn't want to. I didn't want to, you know, look at myself. I didn't want to skip mirrors when I was, you know, down the line. I didn't want to have to shield myself from looking at myself or from talking to my children. And I didn't think I did anything wrong. So I decided not to take that plea. I decided to go to trial. Being a lawyer, I thought I knew about the criminal justice system. You know, I had been top of my class or near top of my class in law school, law review, you know, worked for Sullivan and Cromwell, one of the best firms out there. And still, I knew if I was to say less than nothing about the criminal justice system, I would be overestimating my abilities.
So tell us, because this affected your family right away. This was not, I mean, because you found out about it the same time they did.
Yes.
So what was the effect on your family? What was going on? Your wife must have been freaking out.
It was traumatic. And that's the whole thing. It was designed to terrorize, obviously, designed to get me to cooperate. You know, and I'm not justifying it, but insider trading is a victimless crime. It's not like I was blowing up, you know, I had a nuclear bomb that was going to detonate in Grand Central. This isn't Jack Bauer in 24 where you had to send the drug dogs and the FBI SWAT team guns drawn to stop me. Mm-hmm. It was done solely to terrorize and get me to cooperate and to embarrass, obviously, and act mm-hmm. as a deterrent. But, you know, I had young kids at the time who mm-hmm. witnessed this and were terrified. I had a wife who was bawling. And then they saw their dad cuffed and stuffed in front of them and taken away. And then, you know, as you guys well know, this isn't law and order. None of this is, you know, 42 minutes to when you're arrested, to your plea, to your trial, to your sentencing. It's 2 years on pretrial before I even got a chance to present my side, again, in a system that's very different than any of us understand or that we're taught in law school. I mean, it's a very, you know, and I think things have changed a little bit since then, but it's not this idealistic, hey, it's an objective system where
While you're going through this, these 2 years, did you think that you should have taken the plea?
Not at that time. And it got a little complicated with game theory, not to digress too much, but the feds eventually came back and also offered a deferred prosecution if my two co-defendants pled. At the time, everybody else pled out except my partner and his brother. So there are three of us left, and the feds sort of wink-wink said, hey, if those two plea, we'll give you a deferred prosecution, because that's what we were arguing for. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't have wasted the resources to take me to trial, especially offering a probation, no fine deal. So even if I wanted to plea, Babs, it was very difficult because, you know, had my partner pled, they would have dropped the case or a deferred prosecution, which is the equivalent of dropping the case. That's the holy grail in this type of scenario.
So you saw the carrot of turning the negative sum game into the positive sum game. And it didn't quite work out that way.
No, you know, and I kind of knew it wasn't going to. My partner was a little bit of insane, for lack of a better word, and, you know, very much in the sort of vein of, hey, if OJ got off, I'm going to get off. There's no way I can be convicted, and didn't have any legal background.
as we're all kind of insane under that kind of trauma and pressure.
Sure. Yeah, some more than others, though. It's like anything else. It's a probabilistic analysis. If I go to trial... And for me, again, they were offering me probation, so I didn't think my eventual sentence, if I went to trial, would be that horrific.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I knew he was getting 10 years, and I tried to explain to him, hey, 10 years is nothing to laugh at. Nobody's, you know, you have no idea what it's like to be there for a year, much less 10 years.
Yeah.
You could take a plea and do three, and he was younger. He was about 10 years younger than me. He was in his 30s. Mm. You know, take that plea and move on with your life, because he was dead to rights. There was... 7 informants with body wires and tapes. There was 500 hours of tape.
So Eagle was his takedown.
It was. Okay. It was. Mm-hmm. To a very big degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do we know those informants? I mean,
I'm friendly with one or two of them today.
You know them, but do I know them?
You do know one of them very well.
That's what I thought. That's what I thought.
So he doesn't take the plea deal.
No.
He gets sentenced.
He goes to trial. We all go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was DOA. My trial, again, I couldn't separate it, which was really a fait accompli then for me, because they just sat us next to each other and said, partner, friend. He got 10 years. He got sentenced to 10 years. Mm. His brother got about 3 years, and I got 30 months. And eventually, you know, settled it with the government. For $30,000 was the amount that they ended up settling with me and said I made on this insider trading trade. Again, I was managing a firm at the time that had about $250 million in assets.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, again, a very small fraction and a very controversial case because of our judge and because of some other things that happened and because of the timing. It was, you know, the financial crisis and people were looking for... I don't want to use the word scapegoats because there was definitely a couple people who were very guilty, including Raj, including my partner and some others. But I think it made the public feel good. And that was certainly the prosecutorial approach was, hey, we're not going to prosecute these banks that, you know, ended up getting fined $400 billion and basically helped tank the economy and a lot of mortgage fraud. Let's go after some people where we can explain it. Everybody's seen Wall Street by Oliver Stone. Everybody knows insider trading. It's a little bit easier to define than CDOs and mortgage fraud and whatnot. So, you know, they selected a group that they thought fit this narrative that they could hold up to the public and say, we got them. The economy's safe again. You can start putting your money in banks again. You can start investing again. Yeah. So, you know,
did you do time? Did you go in?
I did. I did 21 months.
Okay.
All right. Before we get there, so there must have been a huge difference between actual loss and fraud loss calculation.
Yes.
So, what if you would? Why don't you kind of explain that? Because even though we have a lot of listeners, who are criminal justice related. There are particulars in financial crimes that you come to learn to understand, and one of those is that there's a fraud loss calculation, but that doesn't necessarily represent the amount of money that somebody actually lost.
Right. So in the case of insider trading, it's flipped on its head. There's no real losses, right? It's a victimless crime, except you could say it's the market, but it's not like you lost money. If I bought your stock because I had inside information, you actually made more money than you would have made because I'm trying to get more stock if I had that inside information. So there's no loss. It's not Bernie Madoff. It's not one of these other things where somebody looked somebody in the eye and stole their money.
Yeah.
This is just using illicit information to your own advantage, and it's illegal and it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But for that case, they flip it to your gains, and the gains are the calculation that they use. And of course, in these types of cases, the feds, like in any other case, can stack charges, they can stack trades, they can use, you know, I call it government math to get to a number. And obviously, they want to get to the highest number they can because that increases the leverage they have to try to get a plea deal out of you. But, it, you know, there's also enhancements in these types of cases. So sophisticated means, you know, I wasn't hit with that, but my partner was because he used a prepaid cell phone. Or leadership, you know, if you're the leader of this conspiracy ring, which my partner was, he got hit with another enhancement. Mm-hmm. So he ended up, the 10-year sentence wasn't derived from his gains because he didn't make that much money. He probably made a couple hundred thousand. And in the overall scheme, he ended up losing Raj $50 million because he didn't have great information. It was like third or fourth hand from a lawyer who was kind of, you know, eavesdropping and trying to listen in at lunch and doing those types of things. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was all enhancements and it was all a judge who was a hang 'em high and his reputation was based on, you know, stiff sentences. The Wall Street Journal ran an analysis of every other jurist where the sentences would be in this case. And then you have, you know, like two or three standard deviations above him, you had our judge. Mm-hmm. So that's how they calculate the gains. In my case, they tried to charge me with, you know, a couple hundred thousand in trades. And then after for sentencing, that's the number they use. But then they come back after sentencing, say, all right, here's the real number that it was. Pay that fine and you won't owe any, you know.
So the so-called trial penalty, what was the difference between the best plea deal you could have gotten and then what you ultimately got?
And that's a phenomenal question. It goes to the heart of the system to some degree. You know, you have that Sixth Amendment right to a trial. In my case, they offered me a probation deal. Plead guilty and you will get probation. No prison sentence. I turned down that deal. I went to trial. That's the only difference in my case. There wasn't a superseding indictment. There wasn't anything else that approached. After I got convicted, the government was arguing for 48 months, basically 47 months, I believe it was. So they wanted 4 years after conviction. Now, that's very different, obviously, from probation. And again, the only difference was I exercised my right to a jury trial. So that's what happens, obviously, in a lot of the drug cases I saw while I was away and a lot of the other places is they'll push you to plea and you almost have to plea because some of the sentences in the drug cases are 25 years for a first time crime, 30 years. If you go to trial, I mean, they crack you on the head. So, you know, a rational person will take anything. I mean, you know, in my case, if they had offered me or if I knew I was facing 10 years like my partner, I would have pled guilty no matter what, whether I wasn't guilty. If they said plead guilty to the Kennedy assassination, I would have pled guilty because I don't want to do 10 years in prison. So,
yeah.
That's the strange math that's used in order to coerce defendants, whether they're guilty or not, to plea. And that's only one of the things. Obviously, you know, lack of bail and other types of, you know, means and not being able to afford counsel and whatnot all go into that equation.
But even in white collar, we see that kind of disparity. I mean, people are looking at a lot of time, not because their behavior was different, but because the loss calculation is so large. And so very few of those cases actually ever go to trial because it's just too risky.
Right. Yeah. And I'll give you just, again, depending on who you have as a jurist matters as well. Mm. So in this case, again, Judge Sullivan was the jurist. My partner got 10 years for being a fourth hand tipper tippy, making a couple hundred thousand. Mm-hmm. Rajat Gupta, who you mentioned earlier, was a Goldman Sachs board member. That's the definition of an insider in insider trading. Mm-hmm. A Goldman Sachs board member who tipped Raj. Raj made about $17 million on that trade. Mm-hmm. He got 2 years from Judge Rakoff because it was Judge Rakoff. And I respect Judge Rakoff. I think he's one of the finest jurists in, you know, the Second Circuit.
Well, Jed Rakoff is very progressive. I mean, he's definitely leading a new charge about reasonableness in terms of sentencing.
Progressive and independent. And independent. I mean, he's served his time as a defense lawyer. Yeah. So when you're on the other side and you see what it's like, that, I think, lends a whole new perspective to the equation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, most of the judges, obviously, as you know, are prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, it's the home team. So you automatically are tilting the field to the prosecutors. You're giving them the tools to enable certain things that will make it easier to prosecute a case, higher sentences, whether it's charge stacking or whatnot. So Rakoff, I think, you know, and I think one of the keys to criminal justice reform would be to have some type of judiciary that is a little more independent, that maybe has to serve time as a defense lawyer, that, you know, maybe sits in on plea deals as well, where a lot of this sort of leverage and coercion takes place.
So were you pre-Newman, pre-Salmon, pre-all of that?
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
That is, you know, Judge Sullivan, in every single case after mine, was overturned. Mm-hmm. He gave the wrong jury instructions in my case. He gave the government a lower burden of proof to jump over, where they didn't have to prove knowledge or a benefit from a tipper. And then in every single case after mine, he was overturned. Newman and whatnot. Unfortunately, in my case, I had already exhausted my direct appeal and gone to prison. So it was a little too late, whatnot. You know, we still had a habeas corpus plea that we did or appeal. Unfortunately, that goes right back to Judge Sullivan, which is like asking a referee who made an incorrect mistake to overrule himself. Instead of doing the right thing, he chose to let that decision stand.
Okay, so you do your 21 months.
Yep.
So we could, because we only got like a little bit of time.
I'm sorry.
So you do your 21 months.
Yeah.
You come out. What happens?
Come out and start with the shirt on my back. I mean, you know, I was.
Are you allowed to go back and trade?
Nothing.
Okay.
I lost. I was a lawyer, so I lost my law degree. I lost my chartered financial analyst
degree.
Lost your
license.
Law license. Lost all my, you know, securities licenses, you know, reputation,
forever
career, finances.
Forever and ever, or can you get them back?
In New York, you can get your law license back in 7 years. And that's something I am considering. You know, I would like to be able to give back and help people from more of a pro bono, less a career perspective, but be able to help people who were in similar situations. And I do counsel people now, don't charge them, but there were a lot of people who weighed in for me and told me about what I could expect from the criminal justice system, from the prison system. And none of those people charged me or you know, they helped me. So I try to do the same. And I've talked to almost every white collar guy, as I know you have too. And many others, that anybody who calls me and asks me to speak to somebody, I will do that automatically for them. But I got out, started
Where'd you serve, by the way?
I served at Lewisburg, which is, you know, Pennsylvania. You could see Bucknell College, which I went to Lafayette for college. So it's a Patriot League, you know, right there. A little different environment than when I was in college.
I was right down the road in Allenwood.
Yeah.
So, you know, when my... When my daughters would visit me, and they were and they would go to like the local Bennigan's or Houlihan's, the waiter would come over and say to them, "You going to prison or Bucknell?"
Yeah, there's only really two things to do in that town. So, you know, and sometimes it's sort of similar depending on you know, where you're coming from.
So
I got out. And, you know, started from scratch. Unfortunately, as you guys know, the post-prison re-entry system has a lot of flaws in it. Mm-hmm. So I was in the Bronx halfway house. That was a disaster.
How long were you there?
I was there 6 months.
Wow, that's a good amount of time.
You know, I was on home confinement for about three of that. So about six total, but three home confinement. And, you know, I joke the only thing worse than a Bronx halfway house is prison. And the way it was set up back then, and I think things have changed a little bit, is that, you know, you're basically, and it's a cliche, but you're set up to fail. How do you go find a job when you can't have a cell phone? How do you go, you know, and return an employer's call when there's a payphone and you're waiting in line with 10 people? How do those employers call you to book an interview when they just call a payphone and some other, you know, not inmate, but some other just person who was just released answers that phone? Mm-hmm. And then you have to get request permissions and everything else. And it's, you know, all the incentives are wrong in that entire system. It's it's not geared towards getting people out, getting them gainfully employed. It's just checking boxes. It's making sure it's full because they get compensated based on it's full.
But they make you get a job.
They do.
And did you get one?
I did. You know, I'm incredibly fortunate to have a good set of friends and family. And I did have a job waiting for me when I got out. And I also, you know, I was ready to hustle. I mean, I was angry, but I was also relieved and happy and thrilled that I got to be a father again. I mean, prison is a horrible experience. I don't wish it on anybody, but it's doubly horrible if you're a father or a mother and you have children waiting, especially young children. You know, and I was sort of ripped from my children's lives, or you know, my actions took me away from my children. I don't want to say I wasn't responsible at all. And to go back to that, you know, we're always responsible in the end for our choices. I chose to be in a partnership with somebody, you know, who I don't respect and was aggressive in certain other areas. And I sort of tried to be a little too cute by half and saying, oh, just because he's personally like that doesn't mean in business he's like this.
Yeah.
So in the end, I'm the one responsible. Mm-hmm. I'm not the prosecutor, not the judge, not anybody else. But I got to get out and be a father. And that was, you know, incredible. And prison, like I said, it's a horrible experience. But in some ways, especially if your sentence is minor like mine was, and I'm not saying it's minor to me, it was incredibly devastating to my family and friends.
Did you get divorced?
I did. My wife served me while I was in prison and then wanted to reconcile when we got out. But at that point, it just, we couldn't, you know, something like this either brings you closer together or pulls you apart, and we both allowed it to pull ourselves farther apart.
It doesn't bring many closer together.
No.
But
so getting out, I was fortunate enough to be able to spend, you know, every weekend that first year with my kids and a lot of other time. And then I started hustling. I had written the book while I was in prison. It was about 800 pages. I had to edit that down. Nobody wants to read 800 pages on anything.
Nobody wants to read 3 pages.
No, especially today. I mean, a blog is like, you know, a page and a half, and people are like, wow, you know, can't we shorten this into an Instagram post to make it, you know, less than 300 words?
But your book, because I've read your book.
Yeah.
I have actually an autographed copy of your book. So, your book is different because not many people challenge the system and actually go to trial.
Sure.
So how is that in terms of writing a book and taking that position as opposed to where people in general want you to have a certain amount of humility or a certain amount of contrition?
Sure. And I'm incredibly humble, especially after what I went through. And that's the silver lining or the blessing that prison is when you have a survivable sentence, I'll call it. And survivable is different for different people. It may be 5 years, it may be 1 year or 10, whatever it is, a survivable sentence gives you a whole new perspective on the world and lets you appreciate everything about it and not sweat the little things to a degree. But, you know, what was your question?
your book is
okay. So
memoir.
I got you. It's a very good point because there is this post-prison, not celebrity culture, but the ability to move back in and either teach or consult or do a lot of things from the compliance front. But they do always want you to pay your penance and to be very humble and to say I was wrong and show that remorse and contrition. And for me, it's been a constant struggle, and it still is, because I don't believe, and, you know, history, I think, proved me right. I did not break the law. That mm-hmm. law was expanded and stretched into ways and areas it should have never been expanded. Mm-hmm. We had a judge, any other judge, there would not have been a conviction, and the case wouldn't have been brought, frankly, against me today or in 2003. This is a time and a place that it was brought. So yeah. I do have contrition in that it was my actions ultimately that got me there, but this was not a crime. It's not a crime that should have been prosecuted. It wasn't a case that should have been brought. That's prosecutorial discretion. This was, if I wasn't a lawyer with a marquee resume from Sullivan and Cromwell and everywhere else, I don't think they ever would have brought that case.
So we always have these conversations with people about how long do you go with the contrition? Like, when do you stop telling the story of this is what happened? Like, when do you feel comfortable enough to be in the world without the cloak of incarceration?
I don't,
or leading with incarceration?
I don't know if ever, to be honest. I've hit that point, just to be honest, and I do a lot of coaching and consulting and speaking now, so it's not the first thing out of my mouth like it was for the first 5 years, call it.
Mm-hmm.
But we do live, let's be honest, we live in the age of Google. So this is a permanent stain, a permanent record that can never be erased. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not as progressive as Europe where they have some of these, you know, laws that will shield you and your privacy. This is page one for me. It is all about, you know, felon insider trading, this and that. So I knew it was going to be out there. In some ways, that's why I had to embrace it and write the book. And that's not why I wrote it. I wrote it because I wanted to get my story out there. And I felt that it was an injustice. And I thought people could be also, you know, learn some lessons about criminal justice reform and what it was like and what prison was like. And I had a voice. I mean, again, it's a horrible thing to say, but nobody really was paying attention for the 50 years before that until guys like me started going to prison.
So when you talk to people, when you are talking to people and consulting with people, how do you, because when you first come out, you know, you're so whatever that is.
Sure. Radioactive?
Yes. And I think for the most part, people don't think that they're going to get past however long it takes for them to settle into their spirit about what has happened. How do you walk people through that? I mean, I've walked people through it,
mm-hmm.
and it depends on the other person who I'm talking to, whether or not they will successfully rise or drown.
Sure.
And how traumatized, if they recognize the trauma they're in at that particular moment.
But that's my point. Like, you know, oftentimes you'll get someone who is ready to sort of like, okay, I've accepted this and I can, but you get some people who are still like,
sure,
not walking in the truth of what has happened.
No, and again, I've always been very good about it, maybe because it was so public, but I think the only way to do it is just to have that radical honesty and transparency and to be vulnerable about it too. And Jeff, you've done a fantastic job about that. That's actually how I found you, is you were on, I think, social media and posting some things. You know, you can't choose how somebody else will react to you. You can try to guide the conversation, but in the end, if somebody's going to look at me and say, hey, 10 years ago, he made $30,000 on a controversial trade, I don't want anything to do with him, then that's their prerogative. Mm-hmm. I can't change him. I'm not going to try to waste my time or energy changing him. So you just got to be you. And then, you know, like I said, you can handle it in depending on the person. But what I found is the people who were most aggressive and angry and finger pointing and I don't want anything to do with you and wouldn't return my calls were the people probably who had some blackness themselves on, you know, their resume or had done something themselves that just didn't get caught. You know, and again, this is a highly regulated, a lot of gray areas in finance. So the people in finance, especially, I'm not talking about everywhere, but the people in finance who were like, you know, I can't ever speak to you again, were people themselves who probably had a couple of marks on the record. Maybe didn't get caught, but had done something.
So for those folks, you look like them, like.
It's a mirror.
It's the alternate universe or the path that might have happened.
Yeah.
And again, it happened to me. I had my life upended in a pretty horrific way. It turned out, and maybe that's just the way I've approached things, but it turned out to be a blessing in that You know, I took my substance abuse away. I was able to be a more present parent, a better son, friend, and everything else. Mm-hmm. And also to dedicate my life in the areas that matter to me and have purpose, where I've tried to make it, you know, in that area, mm-hmm. versus just chasing money, which is what I was doing for many years, you know, after law school. And I don't want to be one of those people, like, you know, where I would look at my law firm and I'd see 35-year-olds who looked 55 and then died of a heart attack. And, you know, the ultimate for me was 9/11. I mean, my firm was right near the World Trade Center. And to see people jumping out of that building without going into too many details, because it's absolutely heartbreaking and devastating to me, and I do talk about it in the book, you know, a lot of those people were probably people who said, hey, next year I'm going to quit this job and I'm going to go do something I love. Or, you know, in 3 years, sure, I'm going to take my family on that trip or do something that's meaningful to me.
Everybody has this exit strategy.
We all have our exit strategy. We all sometimes defer what gives us real meaning or gratification in order to either pay bills or do something that we think we have to do or take the path we're on. And that was the ultimate sort of, you know, confirmation that, hey, I wasn't meant to be doing what I was doing. Mm. You know, I've been giving an opportunity because maybe I would have just managed money for 20 years and been an old, tired drunk that wasn't, you know, giving anything back to society or whatnot. I don't know if that's the case, but I took it as a new beginning and the ability to start fresh, do something different. And ultimately that all then looks at, you know, are we a retributive society or are we a redemptive society? Do we believe people should have the ability to start over, to have a second chance, to redeem themselves, to help others and make an impact? Or, you know, is any type of mistake in someone's life then ultimately lights out? And that's, mm-hmm. unfortunately, we're in that a little bit of that outrage culture now, mm-hmm. where one mistake from any time in your life could be enough to set you back or stop you entirely.
You know, one of the ways I know that that you are authentic now is that, you know, we, for listeners who don't know, we have a white collar support group that's online every Monday night. Our new phrase is economy exiled. You like that?
I like that.
And part of the reason is because there's a lot of people on that call who haven't necessarily committed financial crimes, but they're stopped from going back to their careers because they, for example, had a third DUI.
So sure.
That felony will prevent them from going back. And they don't, and they're disenfranchised from a community and they don't really have the resources available. So we try to make ourselves available. We've never turned down anybody, frankly, no matter what their crime is. But you, on the first time you came on the call, we encourage people to say as much or as little as they're comfortable with. And you did share it a lot in that particular call. So while we're on the call, you know, my phone's on my lap because it's, you know, it looks kind of like the Brady Bunch. Everybody's mm-hmm. in a little box all over the country. And there were probably 20 people on the call that night. And my phone is lighting up with people texting me, can you send me Michael Kimmelman's contact information? And that doesn't happen for people who aren't projecting enough authenticity or people who want to be helpful. And good. So I know a lot of people from that call have contacted you since and even recently. So that's really a testimony to the fact that the message you're putting out there is spiritually right, and you're in the right place in terms of communicating with people.
So thank what you. Is the message these days?
The message these days is, again, it's a redemptive message that mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. We've all, to some degree, been broken. There's nobody out there. They may just put on a better face than you and I, mm-hmm. but there's nobody out there that's not hurting or suffering or has been through trauma, whether it's divorce, bankruptcy, prison, or whatnot. So I have, in certain ways and through different business vehicles and personal sort of projects, started this, call it Apex 360, where I try to take people, have a group, I do some coaching, but it's basically disrupting people's lives and train of thought and reprogramming them to have a better mindset. From a physical, mental, spiritual, financial, I think we're in a world that is changing so fast. And it's not only changing fast, it's the rate of change is accelerating. And a lot of people are feeling, you know, hey, this is a little bit frightening. And is this it to our lives as well? I mean, people like me and others who have worked a traditional job maybe are having a quarter life crisis now or a midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. And it's not about, you know, hey, I need a fast car and I want to date young women. It's more about, is this really all there is to it? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I thought there was something more. So it's diving a little bit deeper. It's that improvement on every single aspect of your life. Because if you just hit one of it, whether it's business, whether it's physical, you're going to be lacking. So we try to, that's why the 360, we try to make it a holistic circle of, you know, your relationships, your family and friends. It's also mental, having the right mindset, and it's resiliency training. I mean, again, there's a story to be had about losing everything at the age of 42, literally walking out of prison with the clothes on my back, mm-hmm. and then starting from scratch and rebuilding. And I've done that in a way that, you know, there wasn't a lot of self-pity. I didn't indulge on woe is me, I had a bad judge or a bad prosecutor or any of that nonsense. You just don't have a choice. Like, this is where you are. This is where you find yourself.
That's how I walked out too. I
be a man, be a woman, and figure it out and start over. So it's a little bit of a tough love message, but it's a lot of love too. And it's a lot of training. And I want to lift these people up and give them that ability to get back on their feet. And again, things are changing really rapidly right now. Mm-hmm. So I run a digital asset advisory firm as well in the crypto space, as Jeff knows. Unfortunately, Crypto Monday sometimes conflicts with the white collar.
I'm interested in that whole crypto thing. That's a fascinating
Crypto Monday. I love that.
I like that.
It's, you know, it's basically a devolving for the first time power back to the individual. Mm-hmm. For the last 100 years, it's been giving it away to the state,
because
to big corporations.
It ebbs and flows. Like, it jumped off big.
Absolutely.
And then it kind of dropped. And now I'm hearing it's like on the uptick.
Clawing its way back.
Yeah.
But there's still people. Price is just one indicator of it. And that may be the indicator of what kind of mind share it has. But people are building beneath the surface. And what they're really building is a revolutionary paradigm that returns money back to what money used to be. It used to be yours or mine, and I could control it. Right now, your money technically is not yours. It belongs to a bank. It belongs to the government. Yeah. And I was a perfect example of that. Before I had been convicted or anything else, my accounts were frozen. My bank accounts were closed. My credit cards were shut. My wife's business accounts were shut because the government, you know, was trying to coerce a plea out of us. So that doesn't sound like due process or presumed innocence. That was money that was mine, but, you know, a bank in conjunction with the government decided to turn that switch and turn it off. That's can never happen under a paradigm like Bitcoin, which is basically, you know, without getting too technical, it's trust minimized, censorship resistant money. So they can't take it from you.
We have to talk offline.
Yeah.
So how are you now in your life?
I'm great. Again, I'm incredibly blessed. I've got three amazing, healthy kids. I've got wonderful people in my life.
So they're grown up now, or at least
close. My daughter's
close.
15. My boys are 13 and 10. Okay. You know, boys grow up a lot slower than girls.
Yeah,
so,
they do.
You know, but they're all...
So when you said a lot of people in my life, your left hand went out. So who's sitting next to you, actually?
This is my girlfriend, Rosalind. And,
pan to the right.
and she is... an incredible person. And this is, you know, again, one of the bigger blessings about what I went through is that you find out who your friends are very quickly.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I
the
just
ones that
said
get trimmed,
that the other day. Yes.
The ones they trimmed, you know, God bless and good luck. You probably weren't my friend to begin with if something like this made you bolt. So what's left is a really fantastic group of people. And I'm incredibly privileged to have, you know, my high school friends, a close group of college friends, and now the people that I do allow into my life are people that have good heart, good intentions, you know, good souls. And that's a very important thing in the coaching and everywhere else, is you really are the people you surround yourselves with. And if you can't have a nice group of people that are good, that challenge you to be better and uphold you to a higher standard, then, you know, you're wasting your time, really.
You know, it's funny when you mentioned the 360 and physical being part of it. So you were visiting Richard Bistrong this summer, and you guys were sitting on a seawall near his house, and you sent me a photo of the two of you sitting there. And the first thing I thought is, I go, Michael looks really buff. Right? I'm thinking, I wonder if he was that buff before all this happened, or if he was like a fat drunk lawyer, you know?
Probably towards the latter, unfortunately. You know, and again, prison, there's a dearth of humanity and privacy and all these other things. Mm-hmm. But the one thing you do have plenty of is time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we were able to work out. You know, you couldn't get any protein because they serve you garbage, but you were able to work out. And I've taken that sort of physical discipline and tried to stay with
yeah,
it. You know,
great.
It gets tougher as you get older. I'm almost, you know, 49 now.
Oh,
so,
my God.
You know, the recovery when I was 40 was even quicker.
I'm almost 49, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Rosie laughs at me because I've got about 50, you know, my sort of supplement stack now is, you know, and some of the biohacking I do is very large. So I'm keeping several vitamin companies in business.
This is great. Biohacking, Crypto Monday. I mean,
I like it. Yeah. It's very right now, very in the moment. So, all right. So we're about to leave. Mm-hmm. So what do you imagine for yourself for the future?
I'd just like to keep teaching, keep speaking. You know, I do a lot of conduct training and ethical and leadership training for financial firms and hedge funds. And I want to take that model that I've come up with and obviously bring it down to not only people who can afford to pay, you know, high achieving men and women that want to better their life. Mm-hmm. But then I will also always have a component that is open to people that may not have the financial wherewithal to engage me. As part of, you know, I'm in the process of combining a couple of different projects and groups into that one Apex 360 mm-hmm. group. But, mm-hmm. you know, I have a Facebook group like Jeff where I've counseled formerly incarcerated people and hold my time open. And anybody who has a question, an issue or anything else, I will work with them. So I'm in the process of building a training program mm-hmm. That incorporates a lot of the higher end assets and strategies and tactics that I've come to, you know, mm-hmm. over 49 years, bring into my life that has allowed me to rebound from literally having nothing to, you know, getting myself set back up in a position where I appreciate life every day and try to have a positive impact on those around me. But I will be able to teach and coach people, you know, who may not have the financial wherewithal to engage.
Mm-hmm. So how do people get in touch with you? Plug your book, please.
Sure.
How people can order your book as well.
Sure. I'm all over social media, so you can always track me down there. I'm shadow banned on Twitter, though, you know, but it's Mike Kimmelman on Twitter. Yeah. I don't know if it's the prison reform discussions or Bitcoin or whatnot, but I went from 15,000 followers to, you know, still have 15,000, but I have no likes or interactions because nobody actually sees my posts anymore. So I may start that over. Yeah. And I do think the deplatforming is a big issue, but that's another topic. Mm-hmm. You know, Instagram's Michael Kimmelman. You can find me at mike@apextradecraft.com.
Mm-hmm.
What's your website? What's your website?
Website is mikekimmelman.com mm-hmm. is another one you can mm-hmm. find. The book is Confessions of a Wall Street Insider. If you're interested in business, finance, the criminal justice system, anything, there is a lot of knowledge in there. It's not just a story and a very interesting story and it's got lessons.
Available on Amazon?
It's available on Amazon. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, finer bookstores. So.
All three bookstores.
Some people got mixtapes out of the trunk. I've got about seven books down there that I can sell
you. But that's a hustler's game.
Absolutely.
I mean, books are a hustler's game. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, guys.
It was a pleasure talking to you this morning.
It was really my pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really happy you were here.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah. It was wonderful spending this time with you again.
Another great show.
Another good show.
Yeah.
And November 1st, we've got Corey Brinson, former attorney convicted for white collar crime, who is now prison and pardons consultant, running for Hartford City Council. So he's our guest in November.
But let's just make the point. As when we had Joe Ganim here, Corey's coming here because he has a criminal justice background. He's been in prison. And an interesting story, right? So,
yeah.
That's important. Those are our guests, generally.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, thank you so much for coming.
Michael. Thank you, guys.
Goodbye, Lynn Springer.
Goodbye, Andrew Kaplan and Babs. Love you, Babs.
Thank you, Community Foundation for Greater New Haven.
Now more than ever.
Thanks, Harry.